Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and special guest co-host, Michael Darling. Hello, Michael.
Woohoo!
And you're cheering because?
I don't think I've ever actually, guest hosted before. Not like just, Steven's out of the picture, I got the sidekick hat, and whatever swag goes with that, and he's just not here.
Oh, yeah, you got the key to the executive restroom, the whole thing. It's, the perks and the bennies, they'll just be piling up all week. Well, we should mention that Steven's not feeling well, so if you're listening, buddy, hope you feel better soon. He was feeling a little under the weather this morning and is not able to be with us this evening, but... the bench is deep, I guess, is what we like to say here at Fast Forward Radio. We've got you, we've got Sally, and PJ, and a lot of great folks who can step up when the time comes. So nice to have you on board. What's new in your life? Anything interesting going on?
Well, I've spoken about it before without going into a lot of detail. I teach at the university locally, and for me, that means the semester begins tomorrow, and so I was busy preparing the first week's worth of lectures and homeworks today, thinking about the 70 or so undergrad students that I'll be meeting this week.
So, sounds like you got your work cut out for you with that.
It's something. As I've pointed out to others before, I teach economics to undergrads, and in some sections of the course, while we cover the material, in a way that would be recognizable and acceptable to economists everywhere, it begs the question, but wait a minute, in the last 18 months, that's not at all what happened. Yes, you're right, and now don't ask that question again.
Well, it's interesting. We've gone through these periods of economic variance from what the textbooks tell us should happen in the past. I remember about 12 years ago, I was working for a startup software company, and this was in Southeast Asia, actually, and one of the things that, one of the messages, the top marketing messages that we were putting out was that the economic indicators are not working the way they should because you've got, at the time, I think the stock market was through the roof. And there were two other indicators that were high, and nothing was low as it's expected to be or supposed to be. So it seems like we get these blips, every decade or so, where the theory doesn't seem to match the reality very closely.
Well, we have a awkward and awkward's not the right word, but unfortunate is just too trivialized, but we have a convergence because not only are indicators all over the map, which is atypical and shouldn't be the case, at least not for the way they went, it's a banking and financial sector-led burp, and I call it that because I think it is temporary, but the last time we had the financial sector leading the way down was, 70 or so years ago, 70, 80 years ago. And it took a while to recover. So we'll see.
Well, that was we'll see. I thought you were adding more.
No.
I was just going to say the big difference between this and the time when things were out of kilter 12 years ago, I guess, the important difference is that the times were great then, economically, and here we're kind of stuck in this rut. So then it was this kind of puzzle, and now it's this kind of, we got to figure this thing out. I mean, there's a sense of urgency accompanying it this time out that we didn't have a decade ago or so ago, although maybe if we'd made more sense of that then, we'd understand what's happening better now.
I'm sure we thought that in 1931, too.
No doubt, yeah. The AI will explain it all to us one day. Well, I'm actually, the virtual studio has taken up residence here in California. I'm in the East Bay area on business this week. And as I was coming into SFO, walking through the concourse there to get to the rental car counter, they have this great display of old-timey slot machines. And I've never seen anything quite like it. And unfortunately, I was on the automatic walker. If I had observed what that was ahead of time, I would have walked the whole way down. So a lot of them I was always kind of seeing slightly from the side and from the back. But on Thursday when I fly home, I'm planning on definitely checking that out to watch how the technology has evolved, this technology around creating some kind of put a coin in, create a random experience that's satisfying enough to make the person put that next coin in, has evolved over the last. It looks to me like some of those were probably more than 100 years old, maybe. I don't know what the origin of the slot machine, but maybe 120, 125 years old, something like that.
I'm not going to suggest I've never put a coin in the machine, but I've never understood the fascination or the attraction.
They can be quite addictive. I've played a few, and there's something about getting into a pattern of expecting that next big little payoff or the next big payoff that you're expecting the big one and you get the little one, and that's the attraction is, oh no, I shouldn't have got that little payoff. I should have got the big one. And there's something very Pavlovian about the whole experience. For the folks in the chat room, I don't have any details other than that Stephen is under the weather. I would assume it's probably a cold or the flu, but he'll, I'm sure, be in touch later this week, and I'll be sure and pass on all your well wishes to him.
And I'm pretty sure he's not moving to Massachusetts, or we would have heard.
Well, he might be now, but we'll see. I don't, maybe that's the thing. He could be playing hooky. He might have been in Massachusetts campaigning or something. And now he's out partying, you know, Stephen. But this evening on the program, Michael, what I thought we would do is talk a little bit about how we make the future happen. And I've got a couple of angles in on that I'd like to take. The first is I want to review the Speculist Manifesto. Do you remember the Speculist Manifesto?
I do.
Yeah, we did that, I think it was probably about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, we first started exploring the what I'm calling the human imperative, and basically just been trying to identify this fundamental principle in human behavior, speaking of the Pavlovian response and why do people get on slot machines, but what is this fundamental drive, what is this thing that sits behind what we alternatively talk about with Moore's Law or the Law of Accelerating Returns? Because I think in addition to, or maybe as a result of, whatever those principles are, there's something actually in us, there's something in humanity that has us moving ahead. So here's, it's pretty short, so I'm just going to read the Speculist Manifesto out, if I can indulge everyone's patience long enough for me to read one of my own blog posts. That is a bad habit I have of reading my own stuff. But, hey. It's
got to be done once in a while.
It just has to happen. So here it is. This is the Speculist Manifesto. All right. The human imperative is improvement of the human condition. Through human and pre-human history, we've worked to increase human intelligence and capability. The human imperative is working we have consistently improved our circumstances and are making improvements at an accelerating pace. With improvements come new problems, but the improvements are outpacing the problems. Moreover, improvements are additive, and we can combine them in creative ways to provide unexpected benefits. Throughout human history, we have carried out the human imperative using two basic strategies. Number one, solving problems or mitigating risks. And number two, achieving the good. The first strategy has always taken priority, as the primary ongoing problem we have had to solve is how to achieve our survival or prevent our extinction. But we now stand on the threshold of a new era in human history. Improvements and potential improvements are increasing exponentially. We are moving rapidly towards a critical mass of human intelligence and capability. Our achievable future is one that transcends the expectations, hopes, or even dreams of most humanity. We can achieve that future only by recognizing that we are at a transitional point in carrying out the human imperative. We must transform our thinking about the future and, for the first time, change the order of our priorities. While survival remains our top priority, we must recognize that focusing on problems and risks is no longer our optimal strategy for achieving our survival. Our survival lies within the realization of our achievable good. The human imperative is now to recognize that transcendent good as possible, to communicate and share a vision of it, and to work towards its fulfillment. And that is the Speculist Manifesto.
It's a little thin on Super Bowls and, you know, groupies, but otherwise I think it's pretty good.
Yeah, well, in terms of making actual predictions, you mean, or just...
Predictions, forget it.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, it doesn't really accommodate the Super Bowl, because that neither improves the human condition nor, you know, achieves the good, unless, of course, your team wins, but that seems sort of arbitrary. And but then there's the whole groupies thing, and you know that's hard to incorporate.
Yeah, it's hard to work around that. Well, it's interesting to throw something out there. It's great to just pick something random like that and say, okay, Mr. Human Imperative, the Super Bowl. How does that fit in? I like that, because that actually might lead us a little more closely into the discussion of the process that I think we use in bringing about the human imperative. And we'll get to that process in just a moment. I've set out a 7-step process for making the future happen that I'd like to spring on, Michael, both you and our listening audience this evening, and see if it makes sense. But one thing that occurred to me as I was reading over this earlier today, and I haven't updated the actual published draft of it yet, but the two strategies, I've always disliked the way I phrased the second one. Achieving the good doesn't seem to quite grab the whole enchilada here. It doesn't seem to quite give me what I'm looking for. And I put notes next to both of these today, earlier, and tell me if this works for you, if this gets us close to what we're talking about. So strategy number one, solving problems or mitigating risks, I've now written as limiting losses. And achieving the good, number two, I've now written as maximizing gains. You're an economist. What do you think, Michael? Is that...
Boy. Yeah, actually, that's not bad. I'm not. I'd be reluctant to say it's categorically exhaustive, but that's a good shortening.
Yeah, I'm still pondering, but I think I'm closer. I definitely feel better about maximizing gains than achieving the good. It's all about, are we trying to keep the bad stuff from happening and inch our way ahead, or are we trying to get there? Right. That's the difference between those two. And I don't feel like we had captured it before. I feel like I'm getting closer now. But like, for example, don't you think that Jay Leno is all about limiting losses, whereas Conan O'Brien is all about maximizing gains?
No.
Not to make it into a religious dispute or anything.
Jay told what I consider to be one of the best, funniest Jay Leno stories totally inadvertently last night. Because last night he said, look, I haven't really spoken about this, although he's been joking about it for weeks, But
right.
he felt the need to summarize his experience with NBC over the last 5 or 6 years when this started. He identified the beginning of the current drama as 2004 when they approached
right.
him and said, hey, you're the number one show in late night, and you can't stay there forever. You can't, you know, you're not going to be able to maintain that, so you got to figure out a graceful exit at some point, but we want to keep you on the network. So in other words, the brilliance of the brain power in the organization predicted that in the future they would wish he was in a different time slot doing something different. He
right.
didn't want to change. They wanted to change him because, of course, he wasn't going to be able to sustain his peer-leading status, which, of course, he did, even though
yeah,
6
right.
years ago he committed to get the hell out of the way because probably at some point he wouldn't be able to sustain. And so he got out of the way, and they came to him and said, hey, we were wrong on both scores. We thought the Tonight Show could do it with Conan. They can't. They're getting creamed. We thought we could move you here. You're getting creamed. You know, so it's like, where's Tesla when you need him? So you can take the time machine back 6 years and undo that wacky prediction.
Well, actually, you don't need Tesla. Here's my take. I think that in order to get to the next level of improvement, the next plateau of improvement, you don't actually need a time machine to go back and fix mistakes. You do need a process that accounts for mistakes occurring. And I think that it's important if you step outside of the Conan and Jay analogy and look at you know, back to human history overall, you know, there have been a lot of these dead ends. There have been a lot of false starts. There have been a lot of times when we have moved in directions that a couple hundred, you know, sadly, even sometimes a couple thousand years down the road, you look back and you go, wow, that, you know, that was a bad turn. You know, shouldn't have made that left turn at Albuquerque. But overall, I think we have, if not by having written it down and codifying it into law, but just through the nature of who we are, or maybe through the nature of what it is we're driven to do, we have kind of created a process for how we improve the human condition. So I want to step through this and just discuss what it means.
I'm ready.
And I've just lost the switchboard. Can we get a confirmation from the chat room that you can still hear us? Because otherwise, Michael, just be you and I talking about this, huh?
Yeah, we just have to mouth through the time delay.
You're right. Well, that's cool. You know, right now the last comment I see is if the taste buds weren't involved, the slots would win out. DC, if you can still hear us,
taste buds
he can hear us.
Hey, they can hear. Woohoo!
Yay, we're still on. Okay, that was our technical glitch of the evening. Glad we're still broadcasting. So here's the process. Here's what I think happens when we set out, or even not even set out to improve the human condition, because most of these improvements come about not through someone saying, hey, I'm going to go improve the human condition. Frequently it's someone saying, I want to improve the condition of my immediate community, right? I want to improve the condition of my tribe or my country or my family trying to get ahead of themselves. Yeah, people are dealing with an individual personal problem. They put a solution in place, and that solution gets picked up and replicated and becomes part of the knowledge that we have as a species that enables other people not necessarily to have to deal with that problem. So the first step in the process is to identify the possibility. And we've talked quite a bit about possibility on this program, and I think the important thing that you have to do when you're dealing with possibility is to sort out what's possible from what's probable and what's probable from what's likely. Because you want to spend your time, most of your time, if you're going to devote your life to something, most people are more comfortable feeling like, well, but I want something that's actually going to happen. I want to work on a thing that, you know, if I'm going to spend, forget your life, if I'm going to spend a whole day doing something, I want it to pan out. I want it to I want it to produce a return. And what's interesting is what we like to do, speaking of slot machines, is we like to game the system as best we can. And to consider whether an event is possible is to look at it in a slice of time, in a snapshot circumstance. How probable it is or how likely it is actually depends on what you can do about those circumstances, how much leverage you can get on those circumstances. So we have to assess probability not from the standpoint of what we think is going to be likely right now, but rather from the standpoint of how likely we can make it. And that's going to depend on the leverage that we're able to apply. Now, the way I see it, the leverage that we have comes in four categories. We've got knowledge, we've got skills, and we've got relationships. Those are kind of the core things. You know, if you're smart enough or if you know how to do enough stuff, you can get a great job, or if your uncle owns the company, right, you can get a job. And then the fourth kind of leverage, and this is maybe the biggest one of all, is tools. And technology, really, for humanity as a whole, is kind of the great enabler of leverage. It is the thing that has enabled us to open up so many possibilities for ourselves. People tend to live in a very narrow band of possibility. Not to say that there aren't enormous possibilities for what they could be doing with their lives, but people tend not to think about what lies outside of that bound of possibilities. And for most of human history, the band was a lot more narrow than it has been over the last couple of centuries. But here today, we live in a world where the possibilities that are realizable for our lives have increased geometrically, if not exponentially. And I think we've got some kind of corollary to Moore's law around possibility. I think that even as computer technology is doubling, that what is possible in our lives and what is achievable in our lives is also increasing at that kind of pace. So, if that's true, why don't people grasp what those possibilities are? Why do they stay within that narrow band? Well, I think there's a combination of things there. There's a lack of imagination, and then there's a fear of risk or a fear of loss. So it's, again, probably the point one of the human imperative taking precedence over point two. If we're trying to prevent risk, we're trying to prevent loss, then we're not as interested in what all the magnificent possibilities of our lives will be. We're going to be more interested in how we kind of maintain what we've got, right? So I ran across an interesting fact I was reading just earlier today. You know Roger Bannister, who that is?
This is the guy who ran the mile that could not be run.
That's right. He ran the 4-minute mile, and for decades, if not, I don't know, centuries, before he achieved that feat, it was stated as a flat-out limitation of human capability. No one can run a 4-minute mile. Do you know, in the year following his running of that mile, how many more people ran a 3-minute mile?
31.
Is that right? I thought I had the number here.
Made that up.
Yeah, I think I can't find my notes what the number was, but it's something like that, okay? It was dozens.
It's way more than one.
Yes. Dozens of people were suddenly, within that year, able to do that feat, which had been impossible for that whole time leading up. What happened was that people were able to imagine that possibility. They were able to see that as a realizable possibility. So what we perceive as being within our achievable possibility space is a huge part of what we're then able to turn around and achieve. And it's great that we have human beings like Roger Bannister out on the cutting edge of what's possible for human beings to lead us along.
It's the unreasonable man deal. All important progress comes from the unreasonable man. The reasonable man accepts our limitations and says, example, yeah, okay, we can't run a 4-minute mile, so what? But the unreasonable man says, yeah, I don't care about the world as it is, and I don't care about my limitations. I want to do whatever I want to do. And I'm, you know, bastardizing Shaw, but that's the nutshell.
Yeah. I believe it's, yeah, some of the effect of the reasonable man accepts the world as he sees it. The unreasonable man wants to change it, and therefore all progress depends upon the unreasonable man. But that's the basic idea. It's someone who can push open those limitations a little bit. And there truly are limits to what's possible, as we've talked about on the program before. But we tend to use the word impossible to mean things that are improbable or, worse yet, unlikely. And the analogy I came up with, actually, is as follows. It is not impossible that I will be elected President of the United States in 2016, you know, name an upcoming year. Highly unlikely, very improbable. I wouldn't put a lot of money on one of the prediction markets on that outcome happening, but it's not impossible. Now, Ronald Reagan, okay, it is impossible that he will be elected president in 2016, right? That's kind of the difference we're talking about between what actually can occur and what cannot occur. It has to do with what we are actually capable of making happen versus what we can't make happen. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of these gray areas. Somebody would say, well, it's impossible for Arnold Schwarzenegger to become president. Actually, no, that's not impossible. Laws would have to change, right? But it can still happen. You know, for Ronald Reagan to be elected president, we'd have to have a law change, right, so that he could serve more than two terms. Oh, and he would have to come back to life, right? That's the
law. Well, we just have to change the rules so that his avatar could run.
Right. Well, there wouldn't really be any. Yeah, but you know what I'm saying. Yeah. If people being brought back from the dead became a technology that we recognized and moved into our possibility space, then okay, it would be possible. You know, assuming you as an afterthought, you changed that law. But for now, because of what we actually know of what we're able to do and what conceivably, potentially, are able to do, there's no way that Ronald Reagan could be elected president in 2016. So that's the difference. And all I'm saying is, as unlikely as my being elected president is, there's a lot of other unlikely stuff out there that really is going to happen. So everybody vote for me, 2016. No, that's not where I'm going at all. Okay,
you'd be violating the minimize the risk.
Yeah, it's
because
a big way.
In this country, for non-professional politicians to declare that sort of intention, there's huge risk. I mean, people don't do it.
Yeah, well, and let me just add me to the list of people who don't do it. If nominated, I will not serve. I will not run. If elected, I will not serve. Okay, so the second step, once you identify the possibility, is you have to declare your intention. And this is much more important, I think, than we realize. You can't get to where you're going, right? I'm not saying that right. If you don't know where you're going, it's very difficult to get to any particular outcome, any particular destination. You'll end up someplace. But if you're trying to pick out a particular outcome, if you're saying, this is where I want to go, this is the improvement that I want to make, then you have to declare what that is, and you have to be very specific. And I'll give two examples.
Or you have to notice it when you get there.
What?
I mean, it could be happenstance-y, but when you see it and go, whoa, I mean, post-it notes, right, the perhaps apocryphal story is that they weren't trying to invent something. 3M wasn't trying to put something together that would be temporarily adhere. It's just that it did temporarily adhere, and somebody was smart enough to go, hey, that's not what we were aiming for, but that's good in its own way.
Sure. Yeah, and in fact, that is kind of an alternative process. It's a one-step process. It's called get lucky. right? And it's a huge part of what makes life work. The whole serendipitous nature of life is extremely important. But if you're actually trying to set up out a process by which you can achieve a particular improvement, you can't count on the get lucky moment, because, you know, for every 3M post-it notes, there's how many tens of thousands, millions of lives where that kind of light never shines, right? Where the tumblers don't fall into place, and you don't get that serendipitous moment. So
right.
If it works out, great. And I think that is something that you want to incorporate. But in the meantime, you don't want your plan to be, well, I hope something big like that's going to happen, right? In fact, interestingly, they were almost certainly trying to do something when they came up with the post-it notes, right?
Yeah, I don't know what the goal was, but I think they were trying to come up with something that would permanently adhere.
Yeah, exactly.
They couldn't get the glue on the pad to work and then peel it off the pad and re-adhere permanently, but it would re-adhere temporarily just fine.
Right. Actually, DC points out that getting lucky is a very huge part of why we have made progress. I don't disagree with that. In fact, that's going to figure heavily into steps 5 and 6 as we proceed through the process I'm laying out here. But I think declaring your intention is important if you're going to do other than count on getting lucky. That's my point. Unless your plan is, well, something good might come along. If you're going to work towards a particular improvement, then you need to say what that intention is, what that specific improvement you're working for is. And I've got two examples actually from recent statements made on this podcast. Stephen and I were talking about how we want to do more with the show. We want to what I said was, if we took it up a notch with the World Transformed, this year we're going to do something much bigger. We're going to take it up 2 notches. Okay? Now, that's not declaring a specific intention. I mean, that's me talking as a marketing guy, right? It sounds good, and there's some intention behind there to do something, but I haven't actually said what we're going to do. I would contrast that with when we were talking with Josh Hall about the Foresight Conference, when Stephen and I both made a pledge that we will definitely attend the 2011 Foresight Conference, right? That's kind of the difference between the two. You can measure and test results on an objective such as we're going to go to this particular event. It will be at a certain day, it's at a certain time, a certain place, and either it will have occurred or it won't. Stephen and I will either show up for that thing or we won't. Whereas we can get to this time next year, and I can go, oh, yeah, we took it up 3 notches, right? I mean,
I would not disagree.
Exactly. You dare not, right? I've got the kill switch. I can take you off the radio anytime. So I actually thought of a really great example of declaring your intention, and unfortunately Stephen's out sick or we would have had the audio from this once again, but we've played it several times, and that is President John F. Kennedy giving his intention to send a man to the moon before the end of the decade of the 60s. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. You know, when you get to 1970, you can say, well, did it happen or not? You know, if he'd said, hey, we're really going to take this space thing up a notch, it wouldn't have, I don't think it would have had the same galvanizing effect, nor would it have put the same kind of massive effort into place that making that very simple but very specific declaration of intent did. So you with me so far, Michael? What do you think?
I'm with you.
All right.
Absent that bold statement, it never would have happened. Well, it wouldn't have happened in our lifetime.
Yeah, we'd still be waiting for it, as we are currently still waiting to go back, right?
That's right.
You know, there's been a dearth of bold statements since JFK on the subject of space exploration, and the record of manned spaceflight, I think very much shows that. Okay, so next come steps 3 and 4. I'm going to talk about those together. Step 3 is to define the required steps, sequence, and time frame to bring about this outcome that you've declared. And 4 is to execute those steps in sequence. So this is, you know, this is pretty straightforward. Plan your work, work your plan, right? You want to take whatever that task is and you want to break it down into pieces. And I believe it was maybe Sally in the chat room was just talking about kind of starting with the outcome and reverse engineering, kind of back yourself into what needs to happen in order to get you to where you're going. That's exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. You have to understand what the dependencies are, and you have to understand what order they occur in. And if you look at the analogy of the moon landing, you know, it's interesting. Think about this question for a minute. I'll run this one past you, Michael. You give me an answer. Now, why after JFK's speech did we not go immediately to the moon? Why was it 6 years later?
Because I'm going to blank on it. I'm going to blank on his name, but the guy who got picked to run what we now think of as NASA, said, yeah, okay, there we got to do some other stuff first, and some of it's the basic R&D and the basic science, and then we can start to integrate that into a more lunar reaching plan.
Exactly right. Yeah, the first thing they had to do was they needed a model. They weren't even sure what the right model was for getting to the moon. They knew that you had to have at least two spacecraft, one spacecraft that would land you on the moon and one spacecraft that would fly you back to Earth. They had figured that much out, that it would come down to two different spacecraft. But they hadn't even decided whether the major activity was going to take place in Earth orbit with two major rocket launches, or whether you were somehow going to make it all happen in lunar orbit with two big rocket launches. And one of the designers, and I don't have the information in front of me right now, came up with this unbelievably elegant solution for lunar orbit rendezvous using just one rocket. And, of course, that's the model we went with, because that was an amazingly compact and elegant and beautiful solution to the problem. It's also one of the reasons why Apollo was something of a dead end. that was the perfect design for doing exactly that, right? It was the perfect design for getting somebody to the moon and getting them back. Economical, efficient, safe, just beautiful engineering any way you look at it, except from the standpoint of having some kind of modular platform that you're going to build a mission to Mars on, or a space station on, or something like that. So first they had to come up with a model, and then there were a bunch of steps that, from an engineering standpoint, that they had to go through before they were really ready to send a manned mission to the moon. Right? You think about the steps you really have to go through. Well, you have to be able to launch a spacecraft into orbit. You have to be able to launch a separate craft, assuming that you're still on the two rocket model. But even if you're on the single rocket model, you've got to be able to put two spacecraft up into space at the same time. You've got to figure out how to dock one craft with the other, how to undock two spacecraft without destroying both or one or both of them. You've got to be able to send a craft into orbit around the moon, which had never been done before. You've got to develop a spacecraft that can land on the moon, take off from the moon, and go back into orbit around the moon, something that no one had remotely ever come up with before, because all engineering that had taken place in all of human history up to that point obviously had been designed to operate either on the Earth or there in recent years in low Earth orbit. And then this is an important piece. They had to establish the credibility with landing, taking off, docking, make all those pieces work together, get to the moon, and, you know, bingo, you've got your space program. So they couldn't just have President Kennedy say, we choose to go to the moon, and then go 6 months later. It was a bigger problem than that. It was the transformations that had to occur, the paradigms that actually had to be created in order to make that possible, took a minimum of, you know, 6 or 7 years, whatever the gap was between when he initially gave that speech. Well, I guess the original speech was in 62, so we'll call it 7 years. and when the landing actually occurred. Now, here's a question for you. Do we have a sequence similar to that, similar to the Apollo program, defined for artificial intelligence or for nanotechnology or for life extension or for a post-scarcity economy?
No, but yes. And
okay.
I'll qualify it this way. What distinguishes Apollo is that from both a collaborative point of view and a funding point of view, the objective was relatively clear and the path to get there was what it was. If we hadn't got there, by the way, we would have, you know, presumably would have kept on trying. But once they got there, then they went back once or twice and they're like, yeah, that's it, okay, we're done. So does Aubrey de Grey have a path in mind to life extension? I think he does. Have we all sort of adopted his path? Well, if not adopted, certainly those that have seen it are fascinated by the possibility, but I don't see the same sort of unity. Likewise, fusion energy or the singularity or anything else that you just mentioned on that list. There's not a lot of consensus.
Yeah, I think we're kind of at a stage similar to the debates that must have taken place at NASA between people who said Earth orbit rendezvous and people who said lunar orbit rendezvous, right? We've got a few models out there. Aubrey definitely has a very well articulated, very elaborate model for life extension, which he set out in his work, the Strategies for Engineered Negligible Senescence, the seven basic bits of damage to cells that have to be corrected in order to cure aging. But that is a model, right? That's one model. There is not widespread, certainly not universal acceptance of that model as the way forward. And even, I think, for that model to be deployed, I don't think you have the kind of step-by-step implemented program occurring to make that happen. And probably Aubrey's is one of the best to find that. Although, certainly we talked about engines of creation a few weeks ago. Drexler gave us a very high-level model for how nanotechnology could be deployed, and then in his book Nanosystems, I think took it down one more level to really specifying how the technology could work. But there's no team carrying out the program in Nanosystems, right? The way there was Apollo. AI, yeah, I think is a mixed bag. You've got Kurzweil and others who give kind of very big picture ideas, and then you've got people down working on some of the nuts and bolts, Ben Gertzel, and individuals like that who are actually trying to make it happen. But I don't see necessarily a link up between some of the models and some of the activity, nor do I see a big program to carry out the activity. Not that a big program is necessarily required, but for each of these transformations, we're talking about something, is this fair to say, bigger than Apollo, right, in terms of its impact on...
Yeah. Yeah, and the one comparison that fails when you start talking about Apollo, I mean, there's several things that Apollo and the moon, from a NASA perspective, it's hard to compare to other things because it was unique in many ways. But one area where the comparisons just definitely fail is when you realize that the whole moon landing was fake.
Oh, well. That's right. I failed to take that into consideration at all.
So it raises an interesting question. Okay, so for those that theorize or otherwise something-ize that the moon landing was faked, could you fake the singularity? Obviously, it seems impossible based on how it's been defined, but, you know, what would that look like?
Wow. I don't think you could fake the singularity. I think... You know what's more likely is we'll have the singularity, and then some people will claim it's fake. That's what I think.
Some nefarious, flaky AI will claim it was faked.
Just a quick digression. Do you ever have serious conversations with people? You start talking to them, and they think that Apollo was fake?
It's happened to me once.
Okay, it's happened to me, yeah, okay, well, twice.
And
how do you not get
mad
at those people?
You just, you know, casually excuse yourself to go to the bathroom and then run!
I think that's right.
I've had other,
I got really irritated
with people that appeared to be serious and, you know, if not equally informed, equally well informed in their own way on various subjects until they start talking about, you know, whatever the tinfoil hat topic of the moment happens to be. And you go, oh, yeah, I have to go pee. And you get up and run.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's all you can do. Okay, back to the topic at hand. We're running low on time, so let's talk about. So that was steps 3 and 4. So you're with me so far. We're going to identify a possibility. We're going to declare our intention. We're going to define the required steps and the sequence and the time frame in which that thing is going to occur, and then we're going to execute those steps in sequence. So what happens next? What do you do next?
You lather, rinse, repeat until clean.
Right. And, in fact, it's the until clean piece that has to occur now, because what you need to do next is steps 5 and 6. Step 5 to be evaluate progress. All right? So you're gonna look at sequence of steps that you put in place and that you've now carried out or begun carrying out, because you're going to evaluate along the way, and you're going to decide whether this is actually moving you to the goal. And once again, to use our Apollo analogy, I think there were probably tens of thousands of very small markers along the way that said, ah, we're doing well, oh, we're off course, ah, something has to change. Oh, because I mentioned step 6 is that you have to adjust the course or execution as required. You're not just going to say, oh, that's not working. You're going to go back in and tweak your steps, tweak your sequence, if necessary, even tweak your time frame, in order to get the program back on track. So
that's the repeat part, where you go back to step 2 and say, okay, I'm going to redeclare my intention. What is it I'm trying to do here? I'm trying to do this. And then, you know, subdivide that all the way down to the immediate subtask that you're working on. And then step 3, figure out the steps, figure out the sequence, and then step 4, execute them, and then 5, and then 6. Oh, still didn't get there. Okay, then you go back and you just keep repeating that until you get there.
That's the idea. Now, can you tell me, with your, I'm sure vast knowledge of the Apollo program, what do you think was probably the biggest setback? And what do you think was probably the biggest positive checkpoint along the way from 0, you know, say from who was first American in space?
Buzz Aldrin.
No. Beforehand.
The monkey.
No. Oh, I'm embarrassed that I can't even say. Alan Shepard, excuse me. From Alan Shepard to Neil Armstrong, what was the biggest setback, and what was the biggest confirmation of progress?
Man, okay, that's looking at the scope of the thing in a way that I've never done before, and I can't, it's not leaping out at me.
Okay, well, I would say that the biggest setback was almost certainly Apollo 1, right? The death of, Grissom, White, and Chaffee. That was, the just utter, what have we done wrong? And actually, ironically, the technical problem that needed to be addressed there was not that big, right? I mean, it was huge and was life-threatening, but it was not that big of a thing to correct, and it was not that hard of a correction to make, but it set the program way back, and it was this huge reality check around, wow, should we be trying to do this? Is this insane? We're killing men trying to get to the moon, just in terms of the psychological impact and, the just cost in human life. I think that was their biggest drawback. But their biggest checkpoint, their biggest confirmation that everything was right, I think, had to be Apollo 8, the original first ever mission to the moon. They didn't land on the moon, but they orbited the moon. And the picture taken from the what did they call that? I can't remember the nickname they gave the spacecraft, but the picture they took from there of the Earth, that here we are at this great distance from Earth, and here's now the whole planet Earth, that perspective that no one had ever seen before that was provided by Apollo 8, I think that was the real checkpoint of confirmation that we absolutely are heading in the right direction and we're going to make it to the moon.
I'll go with that.
All right. Well, I think those were the big ones. But like I said, there were hundreds or maybe thousands of setbacks all along the way, and each of those would have required hundreds or thousands of adjustments. You know, every time you hit a checkpoint, you go, ah, Apollo 8, we're doing great, then you just move on with the plan. But every time you hit a checkpoint of, oh, my God, Apollo 1, that's when you have to go back to the plan and look at every single step and look at everything you've said and that you've set out and say, is this right? And in that case, they even went back to identifying the possibility and declaring the intention. They had to recheck everything. But ultimately, Apollo 8 gave them the confidence to move on, and triumph was the result. Now, sometimes the plan has got to be completely reset, and even the specific stated goal has to be restated. But that wasn't the case here. It was not the case for Apollo. I mean, We didn't have a situation where we said, okay, well, now we're going to try to do it by 1972 or something like that, right? They still got it within the time frame. Now, if we had a plan for artificial intelligence or nanotech or life extension, it would be subject to those same changes. So this kind of shows you how kind of far removed we are from a very straightforward process, right? We don't have that plan in place. And even if we did, we'd know that it would have to be subject to, you know, all of those possible revisions along the way. So in some ways, this makes me feel, as I look at this process, this makes me feel like we might be further away from some of these outcomes than we actually think we are. What's your response to that, Michael?
My response is you know, complicated but easy. The complicated part is it's not – singularity or post-singularity is not a end point that we can plan for. It's not a goal we can set. It's emergent. It will be the result of some intentional collaboration and some, you know, happenstancy collaboration that gets us there, or that not so much gets us there, but takes us to a place where we go, hey. We just had the singularity. I felt it. Did you?
Well, okay, okay. Singularity is that, but is artificial intelligence that, or is that a goal we can set and work towards? Let me make it harder. What about, you know, diamondoid nanotechnology, right? I mean, you know, true molecular nanotechnology. Surely that is something that we don't expect to be emergent. That is something that we expect to, you know, go through an elaborate engineering and scientific research process in order to have that outcome.
Yes, and so AI will, I suspect, at the end, at the exponential point, it will be somewhat emergent. But the components that create that funnel or create that funneling event will not be. They will be conscious and intentional and deliberate, and in that sense, you know, it's how many of the various pieces of things that have been discussed on The Speculist or on Fast Forward Radio are going to be required before you can get the kind of emergence that results in either AI or in the singularity? I don't know. And part of the reason,
yeah,
I think we can't see it yet, because we're still far enough out that even if it's less than, you know, 50 years away, it's less than 10 years away, it's less than 100 years away, the problem is it's exponential. And so if it's 50 years away, the first 49 years, it isn't going to seem like a whole hell of a lot is, you know, we're not getting there. We're just treading
right
water, man. We're not making progress towards the end of the pool. And then in the last, you know, couple of hours, everything's going to happen.
Right. But that's step five. That, you know, you have to evaluate your progress and know what it means. Kurzweil talks about that, how the Gene Project was viewed as being desperately behind schedule by so many for so many years, and yet they were only halfway finished when they had 1 year to go, and that was fine because the final doubling occurred in the last year, and they finished on time. So if you're evaluating your progress along the way and you understand what the progress means, right, you have the understanding that you're moving at an exponential pace, then you're okay. Yeah, I think that the only problem from a standpoint of tracking what are likely to be emergent phenomena, the only problem this model suffers from is declaring those intentions. That's the tricky part. We have to figure out not necessarily that our intention is to go have the singularity, but it is to put certain enabling technologies in place from which that outcome can emerge. And I think life extension is probably a similar problem, right? If you've got a team pursuing the SENS model for Aubrey, and you've got other groups doing other interesting things that could lead in that direction, if they're all working to the point where that technology becomes effective, it's possible that we'll leapfrog all of that into something else, or it's possible that the two of those might be combined in some unexpected ways. But to understand what the specific technology we're trying to put in place is, I think is sufficient, at least to get us to an enabling standpoint, right? A staging ground for making the singularity happen.
I would agree. And in the category of declaring that, those intentions or those goals, even if they're waypoints, not only declaring them and recognizing them, but not resisting them. I think as humans, we tend to, if we didn't think of it or it doesn't sound exactly attractive to us at first go, we resist. And that eventually that resistance can be overcome. I mean, I'm sure there were people who thought going to the moon was a colossal waste of time. And as already discussed, there are people who've concluded it was a fake. But the resistance, that slows things down. And the kinds of stuff that you're talking about with the manifesto, it can slow things down in a way that you sort of never get started.
Exactly. Well, that's why you need step seven. And step seven is that you accept no other outcome. And that's
right.
Where we say, look, repeat steps 2 through 6 until you achieve the goal, or you recognize that that's not the right goal and you decide to work on something else. This is kind of a heroic step. And the thing about heroism is it's glorious, but it isn't always wise, because sometimes we need to change what that final goal is, and sometimes we have to stick with it. And how do we know which to do, and how do we know when to do which? And that is the thought with which I'm going to have to leave us for tonight, and hopefully we'll pick this up again at some point in the near future. Michael, it's been great having you back on the program. Thanks for joining us this evening. Any parting words of wisdom?
Go Colts.
I don't consider those words of wisdom in the least, but I thank you for your participation this evening. I thank all our friends in the chat room. Our music this evening is going to be A Glorious Dawn, the Carl Sagan remix. Stephen wasn't here to provide us additional music. Stephen, get well soon. And to everyone listening, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We look forward to being with you all again next week. And until then, live to see it.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try.
Destroy ourselves. We will one day venture.
stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelationships of the awesome machinery of nature. I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky. But the brain does much more than just recollect. It compares, synthesizes, analyzes, it generates abstractions. The simplest thought, like the concept of the number one, has an elaborate logical underpinning. The brain has its own language for testing the structure and consistency of the world. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns, the rising of the Milky Way. The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars.
For thousands of years, people have wondered about the universe. Did it stretch out forever, or was there a limit? From the Big Bang to black holes, from dark matter to a possible Big Crunch, our image of the universe today is full of strange sounding ideas.
How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The surface of the Earth is the shore of the cosmic ocean. Recently we've waded a little way up, and the water seems inviting.